Okay. So let us continue. I suppose we maybe recap very briefly what we did this morning, just to have a clear idea, so that each step kind of follows on from the previous one. So the idea here is that how all of this kind of holds together. It starts off with ignorance or delusion, not understanding reality as it actually is, right? And the two main aspects of that, which I think are among the two most important ones, is the idea that we don't understand what real happiness is or what suffering is. And on the other hand, we have the sense of self, which says, I'm in charge. So this is one of the most important aspects of the sense of self, the feeling that you are responsible, that you're in charge, that you are the doer of your actions. And when you have those two things together, it is natural that you go out into the world, you do things, because you think you know what happiness is, and you think that you are capable of acquiring that happiness, right? Those two things go together, and as a consequence of that, you act to achieve that happiness. This is what we call sankhara, the second factor of the dependent arising. And because you do all these things, and you think that you are responsible, whenever you do a volitional act which is good, you feel good about yourself. Whenever you do something bad, you tend to feel not good about yourself. This will vary, of course, from person to person, depending on the solidity of our sense of self and all these things, but it's roughly the same thing. And because you judge yourself in this way, you are either elevating, lifting your mind up, or pressing it down, or a bit of both, so you can find some kind of middle way. And then, on the basis of that, you're establishing your consciousness at a certain level. And that level where you establish your consciousness is also where the consciousness will then continue in a future life. And once you get to the future life, all the other aspects apart from consciousness, which are called nama-rupa, all the other aspects of existence, they will be then confined to a certain limit, right? Because of that existence. That's nama-rupa, that's mentality, materiality. The rest of experience will then be confined depending on where your consciousness has been established. So that is the basic outline so far. And now what I want to have a look at is a little bit more about the relationship between vijnana and nama-rupa, between consciousness and all the other aspects of experience. This is quite interesting. It's a bit intricate, perhaps, but it's quite interesting because this is where we see that the idea of no self, the idea of the self, rather, really doesn't have any place in the Buddhist teachings. So first of all, I should say that vijnana, the way it is defined in one of the sutras here, it is defined as the six classes of consciousness. Each class of consciousness relates to each of the sense bases, right? So you have six sense bases in Buddhism are seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, and touching. And number six, which is the kind of special Buddhist sense base, is the mind itself. The mind is a sense base independent of the ordinary five senses. And you can know that, right? When you are fantasizing about something, or thinking about something, or doing something abstract which only occurs in the mind, then you know that the mind is a separate from all, everything else. You dream something at night, the mind is operating independently of the other senses. And this very idea that there are six classes of consciousness is quite in itself quite interesting. And because usually when we think about consciousness, we think about a unitary thing, right? Something which is always aware, something which is there in the background, aware of experience. But the Buddhist idea is that consciousness actually is not a unitary thing. It's not one thing. It is different class. You have different classes of these consciousnesses. So what that means is that even if you understand consciousness fully, and you see how it moves from sense space to sense space, back and forth, that is actually enough to understand that there is no self, there is no continuity even within consciousness itself. Which is fascinating, it's a very different way of understanding consciousness from how it is ordinarily would be understood. And the reason why it appears that consciousness is so continuous and is kind of part and parcel of the same thing all the time is because of the mind and consciousness. The mind is always behind there, right? And so every time you have one of the other types of consciousness, the mind consciousness is just behind there and then taking that consciousness and its object. For example, if I see something, I can think about the sight afterwards. I can dream about the sight. I can almost see in a dream exactly what I see through the eye. There isn't much difference. The only difference is that one is eye consciousness and the other one is mind consciousness. That's the only difference. So the mind takes the other consciousnesses as its own object, or the objects of the other consciousnesses. So it all appears very smooth. It appears as if there is one thing flowing through all the way through her. But actually it isn't. And this is one of the things you can uncover in meditation, in theory. It takes very powerful mindfulness to be able to see these things. Very, very powerful mindfulness. But, you know, it is at least theoretically possible to see that. So you're wondering, right, when you start to see these things, the idea of different classes of consciousness, you wonder, where did the Buddha get these things from? There isn't really even, I don't know if anywhere else anybody speaks of classes of consciousness in quite this way. And really, sometimes you get this feeling that here is somebody with an insight into reality, which is just so profound, goes so much deeper than anybody else has. This is the feeling you get, because there isn't really any precedent for many of these ideas. Not only that, there's many other ideas as well that are completely unique to the Buddhist teachings. So this is the consciousness. This is the consciousness that arises in a new life, and it consists of these six classes, so the moving around from one sense space to another one. And then this works then in conjunction with nama rupa, mentality, materiality. Maybe explain briefly what that is. And again, it's basically all the other aspects of experience that whatever we have. And it's specifically defined in one of the suttas that I gave out, Mahavidharma Sutta, or also in a couple of places. It is defined roughly as the other aspects of the five khandhas. Right, talking about the five khandhas are there, the five aspects of personality, right? So we have consciousness is already taken account of, because that is a separate thing. And then we have Vedana, the feeling tone of experience, perception, how we recognize things in the world, right? And then you have volition, the will to do things that we're talking a lot about. And lastly, the material aspect of existence, which is called rupa here, whatever material aspect existence has. So these are four aspects of nama rupa, of materiality, mentality, and there's a couple of other aspects also added to this list, and those aspects here are passa, which means contact, and also manasikara, which is usually translated as attention. It literally means something like the work of the mind. It means attending to things, right? The mind moving around, attending to different sense spaces, etc. And this listing of these six qualities, which then are nama rupa, the most important of those six qualities are the first four. Passa and manasikara are like, seem to be, you know, they're not kind of core aspects of the mind that are normally talked about in this way. So they're kind of, I don't know exactly how they arrive there, whether they might be slightly, this might suggest that this is a slightly later passage, perhaps it's very hard to know. The main three ones are the first three ones there. So the feeling tone of experience, the perception, and the chaitana, and the material aspect of life. And these four things, they are always influencing each other, right? They always have this, they condition each other all the time. These are not really separate things. They are kind of part and parcel of the same thing we call experience. Experience is really the raw material we're dealing with, experiencing the world. And this is almost like a slightly artificial division of things into various aspects of reality. And they always interfere and condition each other. And we were talking a lot this morning about how volition and the will and the doer inside conditions our sense of reality, right? Consciousness is either lifted up or held down. And all of these factors are in the end conditioned by volition. Volition is the most important factor there, because that is what decides how you feel about yourself, how you feel about your experience, how you perceive things, right? When you see the world around you as bad or good and all these kind of things. So volition is the most important aspect in conditioning all the other aspects of mind. So there's a continuous conditioning happening there. But the other aspects also condition each other, and in turn condition volition. So your will is conditioned by how you perceive the world. Right? So if I perceive people and I think friend, right? Okay, friend, then it's more easy to give rise to positive volition, because you feel positive about somebody. If I think enemy, then negative volition, right? I don't like this person, I think a bad thought about them, or whatever, that's negative volition. So these things are very closely linked to each other. Feelings, of course, are linked to these things as well. Enemy feels bad, friend feels good, right? All of these things are linked to each other. And because they are linked to each other, it means that you tend to, there's a certain stability with these things that influence each other back and forth. And to emerge from that stability, you could call it habit if you like, to emerge from these habits that we have, you have to make an intentional effort to try to see things differently, so you can emerge from this mentality, materiality, this experience of the world, emerge from that and improve it and make it different. This is where the volition comes in again, right? You understand that there is a problem here. You understand that looking at somebody as an enemy is not very beneficial. Okay, this person you may not particularly find them very nice, right? They may say things which are bad sometimes, they may not be very friendly in many ways, but if you perceive them as an enemy, you feel that you are giving rise to all these negative mind states in yourself, and you don't want that. So you learn to recondition your mind, you learn to understand, actually not really an enemy, they're just a person. A person who acts in an unpleasant way, which is difficult to deal with. You know, I should probably have compassion for them, because if they are this way towards me, they are the same way towards others. And that means they probably have a very difficult life, right? And so you change your perception. Instead of thinking of enemy, think of like sick person. They are sick. They're doing all these bad things. And when you understand them as a sick person rather than as an enemy, what happens? You have compassion, right? They are heading in the wrong direction. They create suffering for themselves. They are sick in a certain way of using that word. This is actually similarly found in the suttas. That if somebody is very bad or very difficult or whatever, the right attitude toward that person is to have compassion, because they are sick. They're creating suffering for themselves. So this is how we use our perception, our mind, to change this whole experience of the world. So Chaitanya, the volition, influences, conditions everything else. The other factor influences Chaitanya, and we have to use something like the Buddha's teachings to be able to extract ourselves from these habits that we have, so we can lift ourselves up. And all of these things in turn also condition consciousness itself, right? Consciousness is there now, so that is also conditioned by these things. The volition will, just like we said before, the volition will lift up the consciousness, or it will drag it down, depending on how you use your volitional mind, volitional aspect of the mind. Okay, so that's just a little bit about what these things mean and how they function together. But the most interesting relationship here is, of course, not within the group itself, because that is not really what dependent arising is about, but actually across the group, so between consciousness and the other factors of experience, and between the other factors of experience and consciousness. That is the most interesting relationship here. And one of the suttas that I included in the reading list is called the Great Discourse on Causation, the Maha Nidana Sutta. And this is one of the suttas which is quite interesting in this respect. It talks about the conditionality between the factors of experience and consciousness itself. And what it says in there, what it says in there is that consciousness is the condition for all the other factors of experience, but all the other factors of experience are also the condition for consciousness. Right? So these things revolve around each other. And you don't, sometimes dependent arising, origination, stops at that point. It doesn't go back. It doesn't go back to volition. It doesn't go back to the sankharas. It stops at that point. Because this has always been true. If you go back into the past, if you go back into past lives, it has always been the case that these two things have conditioned each other. Consciousness on the one hand, and all experience on the other. Both ways, back and forth, back and forth. And so you can just take that back into the past as far as you like. It has always been the same. So what does this mean? What is actually the significance of this? And the significance of this, at first, you may think, and this would be a disastrous conclusion if you think this, but it seems that way when you look at it. It looks like, well, consciousness is one thing, right? And all the other factors of experience are something else. That's what it looks like. Consciousness is over here, that conditions the other aspects of experience. The other aspects of experience are over here, and they condition consciousness. So it looks like they are separate entities, right? Now, if you think that they are separate entities, then you will fall into the view that consciousness can somehow exist by itself. But that is not what this is about. It is not about showing that consciousness is apart from everything else. In fact, it's about the exact opposite of that. The purpose of this whole thing is to show that consciousness cannot exist by itself, but that it always must exist in dependence on name and form, nama rupa, mentality, materiality, the rest of experience. These things always must go together. And this is the main purpose of showing this conditional relationship between the two of them. So they always must go together. So why? Why is that? How does that work? What does that mean? Well, what it means, well, first of all, name and form is dependent on consciousness, right? Our rest of our experience is dependent on consciousness. That is quite easy to understand. Why is that? Well, because any experience you have, any feeling you have, any perception you have, right now you're experiencing something. Now it's being this room here, this tall ceiling, you know, whatever it is, you experience everything in here. Now that experience only has meaning as long as there is consciousness there. Experience without consciousness isn't experience at all, there's nothing. So all the other mental factors can only exist because of consciousness. Consciousness is like the core aspect of the mind that gives meaning to everything else. Everything else just falls apart if there's no consciousness there. So that's why it has been separated in this way. And that's why you can see that all the other factors are not actually that interesting or that important. Consciousness is really the core factor of interest here. And anybody who thinks about it will tend to come to the conclusion that if there is anything in existence which is permanent, which always must be there, which is the, you know, maybe the nature of the soul, they might say in Christianity, right? Or the Brahman of the universe, they might say in Hinduism, or whatever other religion, if there's anything which is permanent, anything which is always there, which is reliable, right, which you can fall back upon, this is me, this is the real me, it must be consciousness itself. But then the Buddha says, well, actually, maybe not, right? Because he then says that consciousness depends on nama rupa, it depends on the rest of experience. It depends on mentality, materiality. All these other factors of experience must always be there. There cannot be any consciousness without the other factors of experience. That's what the Buddha says. Right? So consciousness itself depends on all these other things for its existence. Consciousness, which is drawn out, taken out of experience, there is no such thing. It cannot exist. And now if you remember the way we were talking about earlier on, I was saying that when you look at dependent arising in its cessation mode, right, ignorance is abandoned, and because ignorance is abandoned, you realize that there is nobody in here doing these actions anymore. There's nobody responsible for these things. And also you understand that happiness is to be found somewhere very different from where you thought it was to be found. It's not to be found in being reborn, it's to be found in not being reborn. So because of that, when you come to the volitions, you are no longer craving for anything, not craving for any particular existence. Your will is no longer aiming to make you exist anywhere. You're not actually willing, you're not wanting to, you know, you don't do anything to be reborn in this place. So the will dies down. Because the will dies down, and the will doesn't establish consciousness anywhere, it neither lifts it up nor pushes it down, because it's not interested in any of those things anymore. Consciousness is no longer established in anything yet. Right? There's no level anymore, because all of those levels depends on the volition pointing you towards that level. The will wants you to be reborn here, or the will wants you to be reborn there. But when the will doesn't want to be reborn anywhere anymore, it means that consciousness loses that support. There is no level anymore. And consciousness is kind of freed of this whole idea of being at a particular level. Right? And the moment consciousness is freed from being at any particular level, it means that when you die, it doesn't actually get established in that name and form, in that mentality, materiality, which corresponds to a particular level. I was saying before, if you get reborn in a particular place, consciousness is established in a particular place, it means that there are certain limits of your experience. But now, there is nothing anymore, because there isn't any, and the consciousness is not actually at any particular level, so there is no corresponding name and form. So name and form falls away. Materiality, mentality falls away. There is no experience anymore. Consciousness is left on its own. So if consciousness is left on its own, what happens? Well, consciousness needs the other factors to survive, to exist, right? So if it doesn't actually take a foothold anywhere, it means consciousness cannot survive. Consciousness ceases as a consequence. So this is what you're saying here. As if there is no establishment in name and form, if there's no establishment in experience, in mentality, materiality, consciousness cannot exist anymore. Consciousness must cease, because it depends on that for its very existence. So, I don't know if this makes any sense to you. It's quite hard to kind of get your mind around this thing, at least initially. But I think if you think about it, I think you may see that this actually makes fairly good sense. So consciousness depends on experience. Experience depends on consciousness. These two things revolve around each other. Take away one, the other one doesn't function anymore. That's essentially what it comes down to. And what that means is that there is no self, right? There is no core, there is no essence which always has to be there. Everything depends on something else for its existence. So no self, no core, no essence, no real me at the end of the day. That is what the Buddha is trying to tell us. So, It's fascinating how this works, and it shows you basically the idea behind this. As I said before, at the beginning I said that one of the things that dependent origination shows us is how there is this continued existence in samsara without a self, without a core, without an essence which kind of carries us forward. And this is what this relationship shows us, at least to some extent. Okay, so what I want to do now is to read out another sutta which touches on this topic. It is a very interesting little sutta. It's called the Kacchayanagota Sutta. It's quite a famous sutta in the Pali Nikaya. And again, today, this particular session is going to be perhaps a little bit heavy, because there are many kind of aspects in here too which are fairly kind of difficult, maybe not that difficult actually. If I say it's difficult beforehand, it's definitely going to be difficult, but it is it's interesting anyway, let's put it that way. So this is from the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Kacchayanagota Sutta, and I will read it out. It touches on many of the same topics, and we'll see what comes out of this one. So this is Kachana Gotta, I don't think you can find it in there. Doesn't matter if you can't find it, it doesn't matter so much. But regardless, this is what this sutta says. Atsavati, then the Venerable Kachana Gotta approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said to him, Venerable Sir, it is said, right view, in what way, Venerable Sir, is there right view? Right, the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, what does it actually mean? And of course, we probably know the standard expositions of what right view means, but here it is an alternative way of looking at what this actually means. This world, Kachana, for the most part depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. Okay, so first part, this world for the most part depends upon a duality, the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence, right? What does this mean? Well, this world just means like humanity, right? People, people depend on this. It means that everybody, we all have views, and we depend on those views in our life. You can find out very quickly which views they depend on when somebody challenges those views and see how you react. If you believe in rebirth, somebody says, rebirth is rubbish, don't believe in rebirth. How do you react to that? Do you want to defend it? Or do you feel, whatever, it's up to you, think whatever you like. How do you feel about things when they're challenged? That's why you know that you have a view, right? And you are dependent on that view. It means you have some attachment towards it. And we all have attachment to views. But these two views here are two very fundamental views, right? Very important views at the very core of what it means to be human. And they tie in with this idea of self, because it is views about existence and non-existence are very intricately related to the idea of self. So the notion of existence, right? Atita is a Pali word. There isness or something like that. The view that things exist. And this view is basically the same view as the idea that there is an aspect in you which is eternal. When you die, you will go on, right? Whether that is kind of the Christian idea of going on, or whether it's the Hindu idea of going on, or whether it's the Buddhist idea of going on, right? Some Buddhists have the same idea as well. You kind of continue on afterwards. There's a lot of self-view, I think, in Buddhism as well. And so there's this idea of existence, means that something actually carries on after you pass away. It doesn't end with that. That's the idea of existence. And the idea, other idea of non-existence is the idea that when you pass away, everything comes to an end. Right? It stops. And because everything stops, that is kind of the idea of non-existence. And if you look at the world today, is this properly sitting there? Yeah. If you look at the world today, this of course is at the time of the Buddha, right? And if you look at the world today, you realize that actually we're pretty much still in the same place. Still people have these particular views, right? The vast majority of religious people, including many Buddhists, and as I said, have this idea that things, there's something carrying on. When you pass away, things continue. And in fact, even if you are a Buddhist and you have some ideas, you know, confidence in this Buddhist teachings, deep down in you, as long as you have a sense of self, you too will have that feeling, even though you may not believe in it 100%, there will be a feeling there that this is actually the case. The idea of existence is one of these very deep-seated things in us. And people often are afraid, right? Non-existence, annihilation is scary. And that has, of course, to do with the idea that we exist in the first place. But then there is the other side of this, and that is the idea of non-existence, which is very often the common view that we find these days. That you find people saying people are atheists or whatever they are, you know, they don't think that when you die, that faith is all finished. And sometimes that can be a very reassuring thing. It's not just the idea of existence after you die, which is reassuring, but also the idea of annihilation can also be reassuring. If you kind of want to enjoy yourself, right, you want to kind of live your life to the fullest, you want to do all kind of things, whether they are good or bad, not so worried about that. Okay, when I die, it's all going to be over anyway. That is one reason why people sometimes take a kind of recourse into annihilation, into this non-existence, the ending of everything, annihilation, quite properly speaking. Or people have a very difficult life, right? Really hard life. And when they have a really hard life, and you are told that when you die, that's going to be the end of it, you think, hooray, you know, finally, after this. I remember there was one of my monastic friends, he said he had an aunt, and his auntie, he told her that, yeah, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, you know, you're going to continue after death, you know, there's more to come. And she said, oh no, I don't want to continue after death. That's been the end of things, right? I've had a very difficult life. And many people in the world have very difficult lives. Very difficult life. She didn't want to go through all the same things again. You can see why, you know. And it's much better if you are completely annihilated when you die. There's nothing really to lose, right? It's just like falling into a deep sleep and it just lasts forever. And sleeping is quite nice, right? It's not a big problem sleeping forever. It doesn't sound too bad. So you go on into this deep sleep forever, and that's the end of things. So annihilation, the ending of things, can also be very nice for people. And especially if you are a Buddhist and you understand the idea of continuing on, right? Sometimes it's good to try to imagine these things. What does it mean to get reborn again into the future? What does it mean to do again, you know, the way we have done this life? What does it mean to do all the same mistakes you've done in this life and redo them next time around? This is basically what rebirth means. It means continuing, doing the same thing again and again and again and again and again, right? And just keep on doing it a thousand times, a million times. I don't know what your lives have been like. My life has been, you know, hasn't been very bad at all, actually. I mean, you know, in many ways, I probably consider myself a very fortunate person. I have many, many good things happening to me in my life. But still, I don't want to do it all again. And you know, seriously, you have to go through all these things again. Go through school, childhood, adolescence, you know, all the girlfriends, you know. Not that I had that many girlfriends, but, you know, enough, right? Do I really want to go through that again? Not because the girlfriends, well, that is the nature of relationships, so that's difficult. And the answer is, if I looked back and I project that into a thousand times again into the future, it gives sense to a sense of aversion, right? Repulsion. I don't really want this. And this is the idea when you think about it. This is what this auntie or this friend of mine was thinking, right? I don't want to go through this again. And the more times you have to go through it, the worse it starts to seem. You make the same mistakes, right? You think that you have learned, but then you forget about all the learning you did in this life and you repeat it in the next life. Right? Great. You argue with your parents, you do all the same mistakes you've done in this life. And that's why it is so painful, because you keep on repeating the same thing again and again. Of course, if you do live a good life, and you actually develop yourself, you actually go somewhere with your mind, of course, you will not repeat the same mistakes in exactly the same way. This is why this idea of developing your mind and changing yourself is so important. Not allow yourself to be railroaded down the same tracks, you know, the same, doing the same thing life after life, but actually changing yourself. This is the opportunity that we have in this life to actually make a real impact. And then, next time, you want to actually do exactly the same mistakes. You will be a bit more, you know, you will be a bit more refined. I don't know the right word for it. You will be a bit more wholesome as a person, right? More, your perceptions, everything about you will be more wholesome. And that will then carry you in the right direction also. But that is what we need to do. If we don't do that, and the vast majority of people don't do that, you just carry on, make the same mistakes, do the same thing over and over again. And it gets very, very wearisome after a while. And that is why when you recall your past life, you think, oh no, this is just too much. I don't want this. I want out of here. And this is what you see when you see your past lives, right? It is very dispiriting, and you understand why this path is so important. So this is these views of existence and non-existence, and the vast majority of the people in the world rely on these things. In fact, if you're not an Aryan, if you're not a noble person, haven't penetrated the Dhamma with full insight yet, you will tend to one of those directions. Why? Because there is a sense of self inside of you. And that sense of self inside of you, either it will keep on living and keep on going on after you die, or if it is tied up with the body, it will die, and the body dies at death. Existence and non-existence, the two, the duality that people rely on in this world. And then he said, this is the interesting point, right? But for one who sees the origin of the world as according to reality with right wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. Right? Seeing the origin of the world, what you are seeing that things don't stop just because you die. You understand that the forces that keep existence going, craving, the sankharas, the volitions, these are the things that propel you into the future. They project you into the future, because these things actually are about the future itself. So they project you into the future. And you know, once you see that, this is the origination of the world, right? When craving kind of propels you into the future in this way. So you know, non-existence is a false view. Things continue. Now, one of the things here, which is very interesting here, I'm not sure if I should get into it now or afterwards, is that it says the origin of the world, right? And it talks about the non-existence in regard to the world. So why does it say the world? Why doesn't it just say beings? What has this got to do with the world? And this is, I think, a fascinating question. Why is the world drawn into this? Anyway, let me just leave that for 1 minute. I'll just look at the other side of this equation, and I'll come back to that afterwards. And then it says, and for one who sees the cessation of the world according to reality with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. If you see that things cease, if you see that things come to an end, right? And especially if you are, again, an Aryan, a lot of these things depend on profound wisdom, so you can only get an approximate understanding of these things. But when you see that things actually can come to a complete stop, right? Then you know that the idea of some eternal essence inside of you cannot be true either. So these things, unfortunately, they depend on profound insight to be able to see them fully, but to see them partially, we certainly can. And I will try to explain to you how these things can be seen at least partially. And of course, as always, the best place to do that is in your meditation practice. Meditation is about becoming peaceful, it's about, you know, becoming at ease and all these kind of things. But it's also, in the end, about insight, about understanding things in accordance with reality. So how does this insight come about in meditation practice? And a very good place to start to understand how these insights come about is to start with the mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing is one of the most standard meditation practice you find in the suttas. It is found in many different places. One of the most interesting things about the mindfulness of breathing is that it is said to fulfill the four satipatthanas, right? The four foundations of mindfulness, or the four establishings of mindfulness, or as I prefer to call it, the four applications of mindfulness. You are applying mindfulness to certain things in the world, certain aspects of your person. So basically, if you do mindfulness of breathing, you do all the satipatthanas, you do all the focus is on mindfulness as a consequence. Which is quite interesting in its own right, right? You don't need some kind of specialist, unusual description of how to do satipatthana. All you have to do is just to do mindfulness of breathing, and everything else is fulfilled as a consequence. Now, mindfulness of breathing, one of the One of the reasons why the Buddha talks about it, of course, in such detail, is because it is a very powerful meditation practice. And the way it is described in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta, the Discourse on Mindfulness of Breathing, is how from the beginning you start off by watching the breath, and how it takes you all the way to Samadhi. Samadhi is the unification of mind, otherwise called the jhana states, right? Profound, deep states of stillness of mind. Powerful, wonderful, beautiful things. First time in your life, you feel so satisfied, you feel so free, you feel different from what you have felt ever before. So, this is the first thing that this shows you. And in this process of Anapanasati, in this process of meditation, things happen to you on the way. And this, the things that happen on the way, this becomes the Vipassana Bhumi. Vipassana Bhumi is one of these Pali words, which actually is a commentarial word. I usually say, only read the sutras, never, no need to read the commentaries, but then I use commentarial words myself, right? So it shows you how confusing these things can be sometimes, even if you've been doing this for, well over 2 decades, which I have. Anyway, so Vipassana Bhumi, it's quite a useful expression actually, it means it becomes the ground for insight. It becomes the soil that you have to till to get insights. You don't get vegetables, you get insights instead. So you look at the process of mindfulness of breathing that you have gone through. And you, each one of you, will know a little bit what I'm talking about, because, well, it's, at least if you have done a bit of meditation practice, and you will know that as you go through the stages of Anapanasati, even if you do only a little bit, you will see that things are happening. What are the things that are happening as you do that? And the things that are happening is that things are starting to disappear. If you are able to just follow the breath, right, this is kind of the beginning of Anapanasati, if all you are doing is following the breath and nothing else, it means everything else has disappeared, right? It has ceased. It is no longer there, right? And then you go, and then you go deeper. Then you follow the breath, and then certain feelings start to arise, right, with the breath, maybe certain stages of happiness or whatever, and then those happiness will become more refined, and you can see how your feelings change as you are progressing in the Anapanasati. Certain feelings disappear, other feelings arise. Eventually the whole body disappears, right? When you get into a very profound state of meditation, the whole body is gone. You don't even have access to it anymore at a certain point. That is changing. Then you look at the mind, the state of your mind. What is the state of your mind like? And you recognize that actually now it is so clear, it is so pure, there are no hindrances there, there are no problems in the mind. All of those things have disappeared as well. So what you are seeing here, when you come out of a profound, after doing your Anapanasati, you can actually look back and you can see how your whole world has changed, how things have disappeared as you go through this process. And the things that are disappearing, what are they? Well, they are just the 5 khandhas. Right? People often ask the question, that is actually a very good question to ask. People often ask the question, what are these 5 khandhas? What are these groups of existence, these factors of personality? What are they? How do I relate to these things? And it's a very good question, because often it seems so abstract, right? 5 khandhas, feelings, right? Perceptions, whatever. When you come to Anapanasati, you can actually see those khandhas and how they start to disappear in your own life. That is what you're seeing when you do Anapanasati or any kind of meditation method. You see the disappearance of things. And what is disappearing is the actual, the khandhas, the personality groups. Right? So, when you're doing this, you see things disappearing. All you are seeing is exactly what they're talking about here. They're saying that things are ceasing. And because things are ceasing, we don't believe anymore in the notion of existence in the world. Because you can see things coming to an end. Of course, when you do Anapanasati, there's always something left, right? You haven't yet come to the end of the path. And because there's something left, there's still things you can hold on to. But the general principle you can see, right? You can see the general principle of things ceasing, coming to an end. And when you see the general principle, you start to understand why things are not eternal. And if you then extrapolate that into into further meditation practice, you start to understand everything has the same nature. And of course, that's very exciting, it's very interesting. Everything is kind of disappearing, because what is so exciting about it? Well, it's not the disappearing itself that is exciting, it's kind of neutral, okay, things disappear, whatever, you close your eyes, the sight disappears, it's kind of neutral. But what is exciting about it is that as things disappear, you start to feel so happy. Right? You start to feel bliss, the more things are gone from your perceptual field, the more happiness you feel. The more simple the mind is, the less things are left, the more bliss you feel inside of you. The more stillness you have, the less movement there is, the more, again, the more happy you are. So this is kind of a weird thing, and you start to understand that this idea of cessation actually is an incredibly positive idea. The more things cease, the better you feel about yourself, and the better is everything, basically, in life. So that is fascinating, right? Because sometimes, if you take these things as a purely theoretical teaching, you think, oh no, cessation, too scary. But when you look at your own experience, wow, actually, it's really, really good. It's really nice when things cease. The simpler life is, the simpler your mind is, the better everything seems to be. Right? Wow, cessation. Now you're getting into it, right? And you start thinking about cessation in a really positive way. Wow, if everything were to cease, wouldn't that be wonderful? I'd be even happier than I am now. And you extrapolate into the future that way. So this is the way of kind of starting to overcome some of the roadblocks, right? Where the Buddha's teachings seem to be scary. It's just we're thinking about it in the wrong way, and that's why it seems scary. Actually, it is a very, very, very beautiful and powerful teaching. And this is what I'm trying to kind of point out here. Okay. So, so then you understand that existence is wrong and non-existence is wrong. And this is where it gets radical, right? This is where it gets so different, because either people think of the world in terms of existence, or they think of the world in terms of non-existence. Either you pass away when you die and if nothing happens, you finish everything, or you continue on. This idea that there is some middle way is really radical. And this is, of course, Buddhism again. Buddhism is always the most radical child in class, right? The most rebellious kid is kind of the Buddhist teaching. So before I go on to that, I just want to, I said I was going to talk a little bit about why they use the word world here. Why is it called the origin of the world? Why is it not just called the origin of a being rather than the origin of the world? What has this got to do with the origin of the world? And I thought that is a very interesting point in its own right. And to draw out the meaning of this, I would... this is not a suit of a discourse which isn't actually in here, which I didn't occur to me I was going to talk about it, so that's why I didn't include it. But it might be interesting just to talk about this very briefly. And you may very well have heard about this teaching. It's the Rohitasa Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, very famous sutta about the world's first cosmonaut, the world's first astronaut. 2,500 years ago, they had this astronaut. He was a Buddhist, right? The first astronaut in the world. Anyway, this is just being silly. He's not a real astronaut. But he said, he goes to the Buddha, and he says to the Buddha, that I have all these supernormal powers, right? And using these supernormal powers, I have walked as far as I possibly can. My stride is as wide as the earth, right? So he takes one step and he crosses the earth. And even though I took such stride, and I never stopped except to eat, to drink, and to go to the toilet, and I did this for 100 years, I couldn't find the end of the world. Right? It's just like peering out in the telescope, right? There's no end to this universe. There's this galaxy after galaxy, quasar after quasar, black hole after black hole. It just continues on forever. No end to be found. And this is what he was saying 2,500 years ago, which also is interesting. And the Buddha says to him, you're looking in the wrong place. The world is not out there. The world is inside of you. That is the world in the Buddha's teachings. The world is found in this fabric of body with this consciousness. That is what is the world. The ending of the world is found in here. The beginning, the origin of the world is found in here. And the path leading to the cessation of the world is found in this fabric of body with this consciousness. Right? So this is where it is. And what does that mean? And this is kind of the interesting thing. Now we're getting into speculative territory, right? We're saying we shouldn't philosophize, but what does this mean, that the world is inside of us? And I think what it means, and it's hard to be absolutely certain about this, and you can reflect for yourself if you like it. I think what it means is that the only thing that we can know at the end of the day is our own experience. All we have is our own experience, right? That's all we have. And as far as we know, that is all that is. Can we really say anything about the world out there? You know, this building, all of these are just my experiences, right? All I can know is that I experience these things. But actually to extrapolate that there is something out there apart from my experience, you are actually trying to deduce something from your first-hand experience, and then you're kind of taking a step to say, well, from that experience also there is a world out there. But the reality is that the only reality we can know directly is experience. Everything else is like a deduction from that experience, and we cannot be absolutely certain about it. And this is radical when you think about it. It's very, very radical. If this is what the Buddha means, and I cannot say that I know that the Buddha means this, but maybe this is what he means. And if it is, it is very radical, because it is almost the exact opposite of how the world is viewed in our contemporary society. The way the world is viewed in our contemporary society, right, the kind of the default scientific worldview, is that the world is all out there, right? The world is material. These are physical bodies, right? And there are galaxies, there are stars, there's a planet, and all the material stuff of the world. And then from that material stuff, the mind somehow arises from the material stuff. That's why they're trying to look into the brain, right? They're firing these neurons, they're trying to see if consciousness arises when you fire neurons in a certain way. And they can't really figure it out, right? It's still beyond the ability of science to discover these things. That's basically kind of the idea that they have, the modern scientific outlook. But the Buddha seems to be saying the exact opposite, that all we can really know is our experience. And the material world is a secondary phenomenon, which you then postulate afterwards. The material world actually exists within our experience, rather than our experience being the result of the material world. It's the exact opposite of our ordinary way of looking at things. It's very interesting, isn't it? And it's interesting because I think that science is always progressing, and in this case, I think that science has basically got it wrong. When science is looking into the brain to understand consciousness, how are you going to be able to understand human experience by seeing neurons that are firing? It makes much better sense if this is my experience, and the neurons in your brain are somehow correlated to my experience, rather than the other way around, that the neurons are primary and your experience is secondary. Experience is primary, neurons are a secondary phenomenon as far as I'm concerned. And I think this is, hopefully, science will one day realize that, right? In fact, there is already quite a lot of science which is moving slightly in that direction. Quantum mechanics is a case in point, right? I'm not going to pretend to know very much about quantum mechanics at all. I don't. What they say, nobody really understands it because it's so wild, right? Quantum mechanics is really counterintuitive. But there was one famous article that was written in Nature magazine. You may have heard about Nature magazine, the most prestigious scientific journal in the world, published in the United Kingdom. And anybody who really wants to be a top-notch scientist, that's where they publish their articles. And this was in 2006, and there was one of the leading articles in the Nature magazine. One of the leader articles there was called The Mental Universe. Right? This is a Nature magazine, this is the establishment, right? This is core scientific establishment, and they have an article called The Mental Universe. And what this man who was writing this article, he was a physicist from Johns Hopkins University in the United States, right? One of the best universities in the United States. So obviously a man who understands what he's talking about. And his argument was that we haven't taken on board all the consequences of quantum mechanics. We all agree that quantum mechanics means that the mind has a fundamental role in the universe, because the mind is what decides ultimately whether a certain quantum state turns out one way or the other one. It's the mind that decides that. Well, if we take that, if we're going to take this seriously, it means that the mind is primary, everything else is secondary. We live in a mental universe. This was in Nature magazine, right? Which is very fascinating, because it means that the scientific establishment is starting to realize there's something very interesting going on here. And of course, what they're doing, they're moving towards the view of the Buddha, right? I always find it so fascinating, because most people think, oh, these ancient texts, you can't really rely on them, you don't know what's in there, you know, some superstition, some good stuff, some bad stuff. No, it's also the other way around. It's actually the Buddha got it all right, and then we're still playing catch-up with the Buddha. 2,500 years later, we're still trying to understand the world in a way that the Buddha already understood so long ago. It's fascinating. And you can see this in many other areas of life as well. That actually is the case. There are some of the suttas are quite astonishing, but some of the things that the Buddha said that the science only has discovered quite recently. But when you read it, I can't see any other possibility than seeing that the Buddha had discovered something 2,500 years ago that we are now still discovering right now, so much later. And some people say, yeah, maybe it's a coincidence or whatever. It doesn't look like it to me. It looks like the real thing. Anyway, so there you are. That's just a little bit of a sidetrack, but interesting things, right? So I thought I'd bring it up. So if you feel that I'm getting too sidetracked, please write a note and complain and say, please stay on topic, because otherwise we will never get where we're supposed to get, which actually is really sitting down on our bottom and meditating anyway. But we probably that's where it all comes together, hopefully. Anyway, let's continue a little bit more. Maybe I can just complete this sutta at least, and then we can take a break. Yeah. This world, Katsang, now, so we have agreed that there is no existence in the world, and there is no non-existence in the world, because we have seen both arising and cessation. This world, Katsana, is for the most part shackled by engagement, clinging and adherence. But this one with right view does not become engaged and cling through that engagement and clinging. Mental standpoint, adherence, underlying tendency. He does not take a stand about myself. He has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising. What ceases is only suffering ceasing. His knowledge about this is independent of others. It is in this way, Kashana, that there is right view. Right? You're not shackled, you're not tied to the world by engagement, by attachment, by adherence, all of these things, because you understand that there's nothing to attach to. If you're attaching to something, you're attaching to suffering. What's the point of attaching to suffering, right? It doesn't make any sense. It's like a bad relationship or bad food. You're not going to attach to that, you want to throw it away. Exactly the same thing. When you are a streamer, when you've got right view, all that stuff just becomes, you're just not interested anymore. So because of that, also you have no standpoint about myself. Again, the standpoint about taking a stand about myself means that you have to see that there is a self in the first place. If there is no self in the first place, no standpoint is required, right? So the duality falls away. Existence or non-existence falls away because the idea of a self itself has been undermined. And so then, what you understand, rather, is that you have no perplexity or doubt, that what arises is only suffering arising, and what ceases is only suffering ceasing. It's one of those famous quotes by the Buddha that you see a couple of places in the suttas. Everything is just suffering arising and suffering ceasing. So again, when you see that, it takes away the problem of cessation, right? Before I was just saying that cessation is beautiful because you see things fading away. Things become less and then you feel happy as a consequence. What this is saying here, the more things cease or disappear, it is a suffering that is ceasing. That explains your experience in meditation practice. The more things
fall by the wayside, the less suffering you have, because all that stuff is just suffering anyway. So the world, everything that happens to you, everything that goes on, suffering arising, suffering ceasing. When you get reborn, it's another arising of suffering in the world. And then when things cease, either in meditation, and eventually when you become an arahant, you know, attain power and nirvana, everything ceases. It is this suffering ceasing. That's all there is. And of course then, it's great, right? It's wonderful. People often think, oh, this, you know, Buddhism is this kind of annihilationist teaching. But the only thing you are annihilating is suffering. Big deal, right? It's great. All you're getting rid of is suffering. How can that be a bad annihilation? But it's not really annihilation, it's just the ending of suffering. It just stops. Right? Just like you are in a bad relationship, one day you just walk out and it stops. You're eating some bad food, you stop eating, so the suffering ceases. It's exactly the same thing. Right? Isn't that great? It's worth rejoicing over. It's worth being happy about. And this is how our view, how we look at these things, just needs to be readjusted. And once you readjust it, you think, wow, actually, this is really good stuff. Okay. His knowledge about this is independent of others. It means that it is your own insight, right? And it is a very profound insight. It's something, it's not an insight which is superficial and which is only temporary. It is an insight which, once you get it, you can't get rid of it again. You know the reality in a very profound sense. You can see this in certain people. Certain people have this incredible independence. They are able to do anything they want in life, not care what anybody else says. Right? They are able to ordain the communities when the rest of the world says that you shouldn't do it, and not worry about the rest of the world because they think it's right, they will still do it. They are able to do things even though the rest of humanity said it's wrong. If they think it's right, they will still do it. Because you are independent of others. You don't really worry about those things. You see things independently. You know the truth for yourself and you're happy about it. This is one of the characteristics of somebody who is highly, has a very profound meditation practice. This sense of independence. So this is how there is right view. All exists, Katsana. This is one extreme. All does not exist. This is the second extreme. Without veering towards either of these two extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle, right? So this is another way of understanding the middle way. And that teaching by the middle is precisely starting with ignorance, starting with avijja. This whole sequence unfolds and it ends up with this whole mass of suffering. The whole mass of suffering being nothing but the five khandhas, the five personality groups. And with the cessation of all that, it all comes to cease. All exists, right? This idea we had before that the world, about the world, so our experience, if that's all there is, then either experience exists in a real way or it doesn't exist. It is connected with our consciousness, so we have this idea that all exists. It's a little bit strange again, all exists, but this, because it is connected with our experience, you assume that everything exists as a consequence. Okay, so that is the, I didn't know it was going to take so long, but sometimes it does, and that's okay, I think. But the interesting things are all about Nama Rupa and Vijnana. And next session, which we have a half an hour break now, we will continue on the sequence, and hopefully it won't be that much longer before we finish with the whole sequence of dependent arising. Then we can have a look at some of the other issues that come around it.